This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. I think we can agree that the weekend is never long enough. So consider today's conversation a little boost to get you through the work week. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz, has been filling weekends with some comic relief for 20 years now. A lot has changed since the show debuted, but one thing has not. Peter Sagal has been its host for nearly every episode. Wait, Wait is celebrating with a 20th anniversary tour, and Peter joins us from WBEZ in Chicago for a behind-the-scenes look at his show and his life. We even have a conversation that did not make it onto our live broadcast. It involves a dinner he had with Stormy Daniels. Yes, that's Stormy Daniels. We'll get to that after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from CLR Mold and Mildew Stain Remover. While you're going about your day-to-day life, making dinner or getting kids to school, something's happening in the dark recesses of your house. Mold and mildew are growing. But you can fight back with CLR Mold and Mildew Stain Remover. It's tough on mold and mildew stains all around the house, and it works without bleach or harsh fumes. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. CLR Mold and Mildew Stain Remover, making the world a little cleaner.
There's a simple way to explore the vast world of podcasts and public radio. NPR One. Hear news from your local station, stories from around the country, and podcast suggestions based on what you like. Turn on your personalized audio stream by asking your Amazon device to enable NPR One.
Peter Sagal, welcome to 1A.
Why, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to say, I don't get starstruck very often, but one of the most fun nights I ever had seeing Wait, Wait live at the War Memorial Auditorium in San Francisco. You guys put on a hell of a show time you do the show.
Well, thank you. And that is remarkable considering we actually don't move very much.
Well,
it's
but,
just people standing there.
But
we don't have a lot of dance breaks.
Well, and I don't know if that would make the show better or worse. But it is kind of amazing how much you do on stage in that time. To what do you attribute the success of Wait, Wait? Especially because, as you said, it's not a very kinetic production.
My punctuality.
There That's you go.
A little joke for your producers. let's see. We've wondered about this because one of the things that is weird about us is I personally never expected the show to be a success. It's a long story, but basically the show went on the air 20 years ago and had some rocky times, and it wasn't certain that the show would ever continue or continue for very long. In fact, there was a joke going around the public radio system. I'm not sure if you were born then. The show was really called Wait, Wait, Don't Cancel Me. And I became the host, sort of a battlefield promotion in a time of trouble in May of 1998, a few years after it went on the air. And we sort of thought about what we should do. And what we decided to do, you know, in the sort of, you know, animal house, they're going to get us no matter what we do, so we might as well have a good time philosophy. We just decided to amuse ourselves as much as possible until they stopped us. And they haven't stopped us. So all we do, and I speak for myself and my producers and my writers and my colleagues, is we just do things that we find amusing, and we talk to people we want to talk to. And much to my surprise, a lot of people share our very odd sense of humor, and that's why we're still here, I guess.
Well, the goofing around has been a lot of fun over the years, and we wanted to play some of your more popular bits from the show, one of which is from a show in Seattle in 2008 that had to do with Bill Gates, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, and a certain update to Windows software that introduced many of us to this animated office assistant that came in a rather weird shape.
Gates complains at great length with the most bitter frustration and anger, much like any of his customers, about his experience trying to use the Microsoft website to download software. Gates said, quote, "This site is so slow, it is unusable." Others pointed to his even more angry 1999 memo titled simply, "Clippy must die."
I've seen that video, them putting Clippy in a car. Hey, where are we going?
Who's Clippy?
One day, the engineers at Microsoft said, you know, the people using our products, they're frustrated, they're angry, but they're not insane with rage. How can we
focus their rage?
How about if just in the middle of doing something, an animated paperclip pops up on the screen and says, can I help you? What are you doing? Oh, can I see?
Geez, there's a lot of trees out here. I don't think we're anywhere near Redmond anymore.
What is that, cannoli?
What are you digging? What are you digging? Can I help you dig? Oh, you got a baseball bat. Do you want to learn how to play baseball? Maybe I can help you with that.
It looks like you're digging a grave. Is this a business grave or a personal grave?
That was from an episode of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me back in 2008. Paula Poundstone, Adam Felber, and Paul Provenza were the panelists. It seems like, you know, Peter, I don't know if this is the way it typically goes, but when I saw the show in San Francisco, a lot of the comedy was just riffing. You had the question, the guest gives the answer, and then you guys just go at it.
Exactly. That bit, which is actually one of my favorites too, so I'm glad you guys found it. Everything after I say the words Clippy must die is improvised. None of that was planned. And the other thing you should know is the line that was the capper, that was Paul Provenza, who said, is that a business grave or a personal grave?
Mm-hmm.
I had thought of that line about 10 seconds earlier, but was laughing so hard I couldn't get it out. And to this day, I'm bitter that he got to it first. And the fact of the matter is, you know, if there's one thing that makes us, in my view, somewhat more seriously, stand out, as we're part of a vast satirical and industrial complex right now. You know, you've got everything from Colbert to Seth Meyers to The Onion to all kinds of things. And if there's something that makes us stand out, it's that we are primarily improvisational. My staff and I, the colleagues and friends that I work with, we work all week. We research, we write, we rewrite, we punch, we do all the things that a writing staff does. But then we bring that material to our panel, who doesn't know what we're going to ask them about. They didn't know we were going to ask about Microsoft or make a joke about Clippy, the people you just heard. And then we just see what happens. And I think that part of the appeal of our show is people can feel that. They know that this is really in the moment. And I think that adds something to it, because we're genuinely having a good time right there, right in front of you. This is not something we have rehearsed and are pretending to do.
Jenny is listening from Noblesville, Indiana. Jenny writes, my 11-year-old son went as Peter Sagal not once but twice for Halloween at ages 6 and 8. If he could pick his ideal job, his is what Adam would choose.
That's wonderful. I'm dying to know what a Peter Sagal costume looks like.
You know what, Jenny? If you're listening, send it to us. We'd love to see it. 1A at WAMU.org or tweet at us at 1A. And if it's okay with you, Jenny, we'd love to share that picture.
I would love to see it. Is it an ill-fitting suit and a shaved head? I mean, you know, what could it possibly be?
I'm sure he was very dapper and very suave. Although I have to say, having seen the show, I love what you do on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But frankly, there's another role that if I had to pick would more be my choice.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. Here's your host at the Lerner Theater in Elkhart, Indiana, Peter Sagal.
Carl Castle was always my favorite, the former announcer, the late announcer and scorekeeper of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, who passed away recently. Quite a few of you are sharing your recollections of Carl as well. Diane writes, I won Carl Castle's voice on my daughter's answering machine for her 40th birthday present. That gets to a question from Mariella, who wrote on our Facebook page, whose idea was it to give a Carl voicemail greeting message as a prize for winning the quiz?
Carl, you know, it's funny with Carl's passing recently. I've been, of course, listening to a lot of tape of Carl, as we just did. And every time I hear his voice, it makes me a little wistful. I love that man and worked very closely with him for a long time. Carl was always an element of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He was recruited by Doug Berman, who served as our co-creator and executive producer, because he found out, as everybody at NPR knew, that Carl had a wonderful sense of humor. And Carl helped us so much in those early years when we were, as I mentioned, kind of struggling, because for so many NPR listeners, Carl Castle was the voice of NPR. I mean, he was probably the most heard voice at NPR, because even stations that didn't carry all of Morning Edition carried the newscast. So he woke up millions of people with that voice every morning for years. And he lent us kind of that authority and that legitimacy. And in terms of the answering machine message, you know, it was in the early days. And the show was being developed, and it was going to be a quiz, and people were going to call in and answer questions. Well, what do you give them? Well, we'll come up with something, you know, like a gift bag or a dictionary or something. But in the meantime, you know, just as a placeholder, let's just give away Carl's voice, and we'll come up with something better later. And we never did come up with something better. It turns out, it was the perfect prize for our show because it was a prize that was both priceless, you couldn't buy it for any amount, and worthless because you couldn't sell it for any amount. It was the perfect prize that represented what our show was, which was a very silly comedy show disguised as a quiz show, and who it was for, which was public radio listeners.
We want to shift gears from talking about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me to talking about you in just a moment. Lynn wrote on our Facebook page, I follow Peter on Twitter, and since the suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, he has offered some very personal insights into his own mental health, which I found both heartbreaking and inspirational. Peter Sagal himself has had a fascinating life and quite a lot to tell. We'll get into some more of his life in just a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation with Peter Sagal, the longtime host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. More I want to ask you about the show, but we'll get to that in a minute. Let me talk a little bit more about you and your background. In addition to playwriting, as you mentioned, you've also done some screenwriting. You have a number of credits to your name, including for the sequel to Dirty Dancing.
You felt the sudden urge for Cuban music?
The van left without me. I've been walking for an hour.
I can walk you back.
Oh, no. You don't have to do that.
Oh, yeah. You're right. You'll find your way sooner or later. Maybe in a week or a month.
I'm Katie. What's your name?
Javier. So what? You know, like 5 words in Spanish?
Maybe 10.
Now, Dirty Dancing Havana Nights is one more film credit than I have. That movie came out from 2004, so I'm not
sure
knocking
it's
it.
One you want.
Hey, I'm not knocking it, man. You got a film credit to your name. And you've told the story on This American Life before, but it's how do you reflect back on having had anything to do with the sequel to Dirty Dancing?
I should say that I freaking love it. this is the very short version. I wrote a play that got some attention, and because of that play, I was asked by a, at that time, pretty prominent movie producer named Lawrence Bender to come and write a film for him. And the project they decided on was based on the life experience of a woman he knew, a woman named Joanne Jansen, who had been living in Havana at the time of the Cuban Revolution. So I wrote a screenplay. I researched it and wrote this screenplay about the Cuban Revolution, which, by the way, is an amazing story that has not yet adequately been told in popular entertainment. And it centered on this young girl who you just heard. Played by Romy Garay, I think her name is, and a boy who turns out to be a Cuban revolutionary, played by who was that? Was it Diego Luna, I think? And it involved all kinds of things that really happened, including the CIA and Batista and Castro and the bombings and various things that were quite real about that historical incident. And they took that. They fired me and rewrote it to make it Dirty Dancing 2. And that story is very, very typical in Hollywood, how things get taken from one writer because you're doing it for hire and given to some other writer and completely transformed. And it's okay. It's what Hollywood is like. It's not what I thought I was doing. What I like to say is I helped write Dirty Dancing 2 without ever meaning to, which is, I guess, if you're going to have to do it.
Right. That's the way.
It also made me very, very popular with young women who were 16 at the time the movie came out. They are much more impressed with me for that than anything else I've ever done. If you see the movie, this is a little bit of trivia. I wrote none of that dialogue, nothing that you just heard. The general plot is mine, the broadest outlines. But there is a scene in which the heroine is at school. It's a school for expatriate kids that actually existed. And there's a teacher who has a couple of lines. That role is something I wrote, and I wrote it for myself. I figured I'd be on the set, obviously, and I would need a cameo, obviously. So I wrote in, I described it like I looked at the time, and that was supposed to be me. So there is an actor who was in Puerto Rico where they filmed the movie who actually got a role because I'm an egomaniac.
Speaking of love stories, there's a tweet you sent on June 8th that reads, quote, "Next Saturday, I'm marrying a woman who has made me finally, late in life, understand all the goopy love stories I used to mock because I couldn't understand what that kind of happiness would be like," unquote. You are getting married this Saturday.
I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's awesome. And you've talked quite a bit about your difficulties with your previous marriage to your previous wife and the difficulty in what to do with your three girls and how that worked. You've said a bit about that, but talk about that in the lens of what's happening Saturday.
I've talked about that kind of obliquely, which obviously is in the best interest of everybody involved, obviously my children and my ex-wife, and I will continue to do so. I'm not going to tell you much about that. I will say that it was very, very difficult. And I went through a very, very hard time. In some ways, it's not yet over. It's not resolved. There's been some losses there that probably will never be repaired. And one of the things that I realized is when you're going through something like this, a real serious domestic tragedy, you feel very isolated because this is most associated with Facebook. You look on Facebook and everybody seems so happy. Everything seems so great. And when something is terrible going on in your own life, you're like, wow, there is something uniquely wrong with me. And one of the things I found out is that if you dare to talk about it, people will respond with their own stories because a lot of people carry around painful experiences they've been through or have gone through. And so that's why I decided to go on John Moe's podcast called The Hilarious World of Depression, the very first episode, in fact, and talk about it for that reason. I once heard Rachel Maddow, who I admire tremendously, I think she's incredibly intelligent and very good at what she does, talk about how she struggles with depression and she often feels inadequate and overwhelmed and terribly sad. And I'm like, wow, if Rachel Maddow feels that way, I guess it's okay if I feel that way sometimes. And it occurred to me that if I were to be public in somewhat the same way, then other people might get that same benefit to realize that they're themselves not alone. If someone, and I'll be, you know, I don't know if this counts as ego, but if someone like me with a prominent job that seems like I'm doing great can be struggling with stuff, then maybe people will feel a little better about whatever they're struggling with, or at least the fact that they are. And that happened, I'm proud to say, that people got in touch with me, sometimes privately, sometimes in person, and they let me know that hearing that was a great boon. One person, a number of people said that hearing me talk about that sent them to get help, whatever the help they needed, be it therapy or medication. One person told me that it turned them away from a path that might have led them to suicide. And, you know, and I can't say if that's true, but, you know, if it is, then it's, you know, it's quite, I don't know, gratifying and makes me think that I did the right thing about going public in the way that I have.
Yeah, and you've been among the folks who's been tweeting about depression in the wake of the suicides of fashion designer Kate Spade and chef Anthony Bourdain. By the way, Bourdain appeared on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me back in 2016. Here is a clip from that appearance on the show.
So can I, Anthony, go ahead, Tom. This is Tom Baudet. I like your show, and you eat a lot of really horrible things on it sometimes. Can you just eat bad food?
Unless it's a Johnny Rockets, yeah.
Wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt just to say that Johnny Rockets is a chain of burger places that's intentionally kind of a replica of the old 50s.
The 50s in Bulgaria.
Right, exactly.
I'm alone. There's three cooks standing there, a manager and a counter guy, and I order a burger, and they just sort of grab a pre-cooked burger, put it onto a halfway on, halfway off a bun, reach into the fry basket and, you know, grab some cold fries. They don't even dunk them in the hot grease. And then they bring them over to me, and they all stand there, and we all kind of share this moment looking at each other. And we all know that, you know, we aren't where we want to be right now.
Part of Anthony Bourdain's appearance on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me back in 2016. Lisa in New Hampshire writes, "At the end of 2005, my son was stillborn. A few weeks later, I was cleaning my kitchen, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me came on the radio. There was one joke, something about President Bush and a zip code in Michigan, and I laughed. I laughed so hard I couldn't speak. In that moment, I knew I was going to be okay and could get through my heartache. Thank you. Another heartache that you've written about and talked about, including on The Moth, which was so compelling, was about your experience of running the Boston Marathon in 2013. You were serving as a guide for marathon runners who were visually impaired. You completed the race, if memory serves, at about 4 hours and 5 minutes past the starting gun. At 4 hours and 9 minutes past the starting gun, the finish line was bombed. How do you reflect back on that day now, and how does it affect your avid marathon running?
Well, that's an interesting question. You're right. I told that story in The Moth, and actually that story is, if I may be so bold, the first chapter of a book that I'm publishing this fall called The Incomplete Guide to Running, or The Incomplete Book of Running, that'll come out and tells that story and some other stories about my life as a midlife marathoner. I had just crossed the finish line with my friend William Greer, who I had guided. He's a visually impaired, across the marathon finish line. We were sort of recovering. He was pretty wiped out, and we were sort of celebrating when boom. It's very hard to talk about, because if I were to say that I was a witness, well, certainly, let's just get one thing out of the way. I am not a victim of the Boston Marathon bombing. I was not hurt in any way. I wasn't even really a witness, because my view of the bomb site was blocked by the big finish line superstructure, you know, the big holding up lights and cameras and stuff like that. So I didn't actually see the terrible things that people just 100 yards away from me were looking at, the blood and the injuries. Nonetheless, you know, I carry that with me, that I was there that day. And I think mostly about the extraordinary good fortune that I had. If we had been a little slower, if William, as he wanted to do, because he was not feeling good, had walked that last mile rather than, you know, gather whatever courage he had and run it like a hero, we would have been right in front of the bombs. I have no idea what would have happened. And it makes me think a lot when I think about it, about the pure randomness of life. You know, there were people there who didn't come home, and the only reason they didn't come home was because they happened to be standing in the wrong place. There were people who were sorely injured for the same reason. And these things happen to people's lives. And, you know, it's sometimes, sometimes there's no explanation for the things that happens, and except just sort of bad luck and malice. And it's certainly something that made me think a lot about how fortunate I am. Let me put it that way.
A few more questions I did want to ask you. If we could kind of lightning round our way through some more questions.
Sure.
About Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, because there's plenty more we'd love to discuss. One thing I wanted to make sure I asked you about, there have been a number of efforts to adapt Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for television, but none has succeeded. Why
That's
not?
That's true. That is a good question. I think I'm very good looking, and I don't understand why the television audience doesn't agree. There were two attempts, one which was a pilot that was filmed at great expense by CBS as a possible network show, the other by BBC America that was actually broadcast. And it didn't work in both cases. And I can't tell you why. One reason might be is that we're a little weird. I mean,
weird?
Our show is a show in which we're both – our panelists are sort of playing the game, and also the people call in playing the game. And there was Carl Castle, who means a tremendous amount to public radio people, but not that much to people that don't listen to public radio. So it was – I think it was very hard for television audiences as opposed to public radio audiences to appreciate. But also I think that what we do could really only exist in public radio, because we are completely free of the commercial pressures that commercial broadcasting is under. I referenced earlier in the hour that the show was struggling. If we had been a commercial venture on commercial radio or television in those early days and getting the reactions that we did, we would have been executed immediately, because we just weren't bringing in the eyeballs, viewers, ears that would have justified the expense. But public radio being public radio, it doesn't have that commercial pressure. We were given a little chance to breathe, and we were given a chance to improve. And it really took us a year of broadcast shows before we started to do something that people actually really enjoyed. And I think it's all part of the same thing. We could only exist in public radio, and that's why I'm very, very grateful to be part of this community.
Last year, we had a conversation with Tom Hanks after he guest-hosted Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Here's what he said about that experience. You guest-hosted Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR back in January.
Easy. Greatest gig in the world, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Isn't it fun?
Well, I'm thinking of having somebody just inadvertently hit Peter Sagal with their car, not to hurt him, not just,
oh, no, don't
to,
say
just,
that.
Just to take his legs out for a little bit
don't
so
say
we can't
that,
get
Tom
to
Hanks.
The studio and they need me again.
You're the nicest guy in Hollywood. Don't say that, Tom Hanks.
Yeah, don't. Oh, Al, you're seeing below the fabric of my good nature.
So, Peter, you've been warned. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, basically, I'm waiting for Tom Hanks to come through with his part of the bargain and let me star in a major motion picture. I don't know why it hasn't happened yet.
So an even swap is no swindle. You two could just kind of do a job swap for the day.
I don't think anybody would notice, given my natural charm. Come on.
By the way, Jenny, the mom I told you about with the son dressing as you for Halloween,
yes.
She wrote back.
Oh,
Jenny,
great.
Jenny wrote, yes, it was an ill-fitting suit and a bald cap. I'll find a photo.
Oh, perfect.
We're going to get that picture. Before we go, two more quick questions. Todd in Ohio wants to know, where did the name of the show come from?
Believe it or not, it was invented by Bob Garfield, the host of On the Media.
No kidding.
He was at NPR, and I am told, I think he confirmed this in one of our conversations, that there was like a focus group at NPR trying to come up with a name. And he said, how about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? And everybody said, great. And if I ever see Bob Garfield again, I will punch him, because that means that for 20 years I've had people coming up to me and going, hey, wait, wait, don't tell me. Are you Peter Sagal? Which is sort of like my friend Tom Baudet's curse of having people come up to him and say, hey, leave the light on for me.
Mr. Motel 6. Peter, somehow, I don't know, but somehow you had dinner with Stormy Daniels back in 2005. How did that happen and what was she like?
10 years ago, I wrote a book called The Book of Vice, Naughty Things and How to Do Them, in which I tried to write about things that we mild-mannered public radio people don't normally talk about, such as, among other things, porn stars. And I ended up having dinner with three of them. Nina Hartley, who's actually somewhat famous, a woman named Shane, who's famous in her own way, and a young woman named Stormy Daniels, who I had not heard of, or I should hasten to say, seen. And so we had dinner, and she turned out to be totally awesome, incredibly smart, amazingly self-aware, a totally funny, intelligent person who knew exactly what she was doing and why she was doing it, and by the way, could tell a story like nobody's business. She had the room cracking up. She was so amazing, great an anecdotalist. So when I heard that she was the porn star that had attracted Donald Trump's attention, I knew we were in for a treat, because if she ever got a chance to speak, she hasn't quite gotten there. It's going to be a great story when she gets to tell it, and I am looking forward to that day.
So the Stormy Daniels we're getting to know coheres with the Stormy Daniels you met all those years ago.
Oh yeah, that's. I mean, anybody who thought that this woman, because of her business, would be some sort of floozy or dumb or easily manipulated, they didn't know Stormy Daniels, and I did, and so I knew that we'd end up more or less where we are. She's. Let me put it this way. I think of the two people involved. She has the upper hand, let's just say.
Before I let you go, are you having fun doing Wait, Wait?
If I didn't, I would have left. I mean, I don't want to go too on about my personal troubles, but I honest to say, if I didn't have the chance to get with my friends and have a great time once a week in front of the best audience in the world, in person and on the radio, those times would have been a lot harder. I have a great time doing the show. I enjoy myself. And when you hear me laughing like a maniac, that's totally genuine. I am enjoying the heck out of myself.
I have just been informed by our producer that we have the photo.
We have the photo.
We will tweet that as soon as we conclude this conversation with Peter Sagal, the longtime host of the NPR news quiz Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary on NPR. Peter, congratulations about your nuptials this Saturday, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and welcome to the wonderful world of public radio. You guys are doing great.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for sharing your questions and your stories, and as always, thanks for listening. This is 1A.